Tonight on Standing Room Only, the third series of student stories from the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship, and Green Drinks with In Defense of the Commonwealth.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
This moth-style event comes courtesy of ASE English teacher Rachel Barr.
The next story we'll be hearing is called A Toy Soldier Mistake, A Funny Story. It's by Aubrey Hubbard. Aubrey Hubbard is a dancer and a choreographer. She likes to read and write. She's also very stubborn, but a good friend.
Once I was a little girl, I always wanted to be a dancer. But once I first joined United Arts Academy, my mom decided that the company was way too easy for me. So she told me that we could go see the Nutcracker and I could join the MAC if I wanted to, if the Nutcracker was good. So we went to see the Nutcracker and I decided to switch. I auditioned for the MAC and, well, the ballet, and I got in, and I got into intermediate level. Then our dance instructor told us one day that we could audition for the Nutcracker if we wanted to. Well, I was so nervous and excited, like fidgety nervous, shaky nervous, like heart racing nervous. And then I realized that I had to, like, you know, correct a few things, like turnout, straightening your back more, flexibility, and along the lines of stuff like that. Then finally, the auditions came. I was really nervous, and I was wondering what the people that were judging you with, like the choreographer for the Nutcracker and the dance director for ballet and stuff, people like that. I was wondering what they would judge me of. What I really wanted was a party girl, because I could relate to a party girl the most. And the choreography was more challenging than Toy Soldier. But unfortunately, I got a Toy Soldier. And I thought the choreography was easy, but it actually wasn't, because you actually had to feel what they actually were. And I mean, like, you would actually have to act like you were in war. And then the performances came. It was the first week of December, and I was really nervous and tired because, well, I had school, and my first performance was in the middle of the week. So we already had enough rehearsals, but I still didn't get this one step. We didn't practice with the castle until our performance came. Our castle was the entrance, and then there was this one step where if you missed it, you would probably most likely mess up the performance. So there was already enough mistakes that night. A toy doll in the party scene had already twisted her ankle on accident because a person wasn't in their place. Then Clara, thankfully, started with the Nutcracker dance and stuff like that. Then it came to our part. Then they pulled out the castle. We lined up, and I was like the leader of the whole group because I was taller than everyone. I started out by like shuffling, and then the mistake happened. I tripped and fell and hit my head. Thank goodness for the costume. We had like little helmets on. Thank goodness for the costume. I didn't have a concussion or anything. However, I did have a headache afterwards. The performance didn't stop, which I was very thankful for that. I started to say I was sorry to the dancers because they were, like, skipping around me, and that was not part of the routine. And then I realized I had to get up because, you know, the show must go on. And I got up, finished the performance, even though I was so mad at myself. I talked to one of my friends afterwards, once we got home and stuff like that. She was like, "You got this. This was a one-time mistake, and it will never happen again. If it does, you did what you did, and you should do it again." If it weren't for my friend, I probably wouldn't believe in myself, because even though I performed, like, before the Nutcracker, I didn't really believe in myself much more than I do now. And so now, since IU Ballet didn't really work for me, I am at Motion Arts Academy, and I am a choreographer and a dancer.
Next, we have Raven Thompson with The Bench. Raven has a passion for writing and reading. She really enjoyed this project as well. Give it up for Raven.
Okay, so my family has never been the closest. So when I lived in Indianapolis, I used to visit my great-grandparents' house all the time. And funny thing is, my great aunt lived right across the street from them, and they never really talked to each other unless they were at church or a family gathering or something. So me being at my great-grandparents' house as a child was kind of weird, because there were a lot of adults, and it was kind of a weird because there were more adults than children. So the older guys who could still make it down the stairs went downstairs and played pool, and then the older ladies who were still cooking and stuff were in the kitchen talking about what they talk about, and then the older people were in the living room talking about what old people talk about. And the children, me at the time, we were just running around and playing. Speaking of playing, have you ever seen a child really hyper and you want them to just sit down and shut up? That's how we were acting at the time, and to me it was really fun and crazy, but to all the adults, they were just like, "Really? Can you guys not right now? We're busy." So soon we were still just running around in the house, and then my mom just told us to go outside and play. And my great-grandparents' backyard looked like an entire football field to us. So there was like a garden on the side of the house, and then a fountain that I didn't know worked until recently, and then a barn behind that, and this old wooden bench swing. But we were still really hyper, so we started playing tag and playing whatever games we wanted for like an hour or so. Then we got tired, but we still didn't want to go in the house, so we sat on this old wooden bench swing. And this bench swing sat like about four small adults, and there were five of us. We were all different sizes, and some of us were short. I was short, and my older sister, she was like, would be the tallest at the time. So we sat down, and we were just chilling for a moment, talking about whatever. I don't remember, but we just wanted to see how high this bench swing could go. So we started to kick our feet hard and fast, and like, it was going high. But to us, it wasn't going high enough. So we started to kick our feet harder and faster than before. And the creaks and groans of these old chains was so loud that I thought people down the block could hear it. But for some reason, it was like I couldn't even hear it. None of us could hear it. So we just kept going, kicking our feet hard and fast. And then, snap! One of the chains broke, and we all just came tumbling down the side. We were laughing, but then on the inside, I was like, "Oh crap, I'm gonna die. This bench swing broke, I'm gonna be in trouble." So we go in the house, and it was still light outside, it was still quite early. And my mom asked me, "Why'd you guys come in so early?" And everyone was just like, "Nothing," really fast. Like, you know when you're in trouble, and you know you're in trouble, but you try to deny that you're in trouble? That's how we were. But then my mom she knows something's wrong. So she went outside, and she saw, and then she just was like, "Really?" It wasn't that much of a big deal because it was really old. So she had one of my uncles go fix it. He didn't put on any new chains. He just clipped the old chain back up there. So we went back outside, and we were playing again, and then we sat down on this bench swing again. And for some reason, we were just like, it didn't go high enough last time, so we'll just do it again. So this time we went harder and faster than before, and then again, snap, it broke again. And then we went back in the house, and we were just like, fix it, like it broke again, fix it. But then they were just like, nah, it's old, it's gonna break again. So they threw it away, and we were in the house. We were just running around playing again until we got tired. So we sat down in the living room, and then for some reason, everything just got really quiet. And it was so quiet that the only thing you could hear was the breathing of the people and the whispers of the people on the TV. So in this silence, I took a moment to look around at the people around me and just think, like, wow, I haven't felt this close to my family in forever. So I was sitting there thinking, like, what? Like, you think these people who don't talk to each other as much couldn't be closer? Like, now I know, like, if something's wrong with someone in my family, I feel that closeness to them, that I know when something's wrong. And if something just happened and I get really excited, like, oh my God, something just happened, I can't wait to figure out what it is. And if it wasn't for that, the bench swing breaking and us having to go in the house and just calm down, I wouldn't be the person I am today and feel as close to my family as I ever have. Thank
you. Max Stewart is next with Don't Trust Your Mom. Max is an average person who likes art, music, and reading. His favorite activities include hanging out with friends, spending time with his pet rats, and sleeping. Give it up for Max.
Okay, so has your sibling, if you have any, ever done something horrible to you? Mine did. I was like 9 years old at the time, and my sister was 2. We didn't have any type of sibling bond or relationship. Like, we acknowledged that the other existed, but there was no interaction. And at this point, I wouldn't say we hated each other, but we were definitely getting there. It was sibling rivalry at its finest. So I had just taken a shower, and I was sitting on the brown couch in our living room playing Nintendogs. For those of you that don't know what that is, it's like a dog simulator game where you just kind of take care of the animals and do stuff with them. So I was trying to win the agility championship with my Pembroke Welsh Corgi, Minnie, when my mom placed my completely naked sister in my lap. She wanted me to hold her while she got clothes for and cleaned the bathroom. Because, you know, my mom's a neat freak, so she cleans everything as soon as it gets used, or as she says, dirty. I was slightly frustrated and very grossed out because she was naked and in my way. And I didn't want to lose this championship because of her. Because if I didn't win this championship, then I wasn't getting the $1,000 reward. And I really wanted that reward to buy extra food and water for my little virtual dogs and maybe some toys. So it had been a while since my mom had placed her in my lap, and everything was going okay. I started to focus on making Minnie weave through the poles. It went from okay to not okay in about 3 seconds. I was sitting, Haley was sitting, then she started peeing. It was warm and wet, and I was like, well, what the hell is this? At first, I thought it was just water because my mom had just bathed her and she was still, you know, wet and damp and stuff. When I put together the pieces, I yelled for my mom and shoved her off my lap. By then, her urine had already covered my legs and was starting to slowly seep into the couch cushions. Haley started crying, and my mom came to investigate. When she made eye contact with me, it was like all the air left the room, and I knew I was screwed. It was like staring an angry grizzly bear in the face. So in the end, I got in trouble for shoving my sister. I had to take another shower, and I lost the agility championship. From this experience, I learned that I should never trust my mom. Since this incident, I've been very weary of trusting my mom. Haley has not sat on my lap since then.
Lastly, we have Kayla Smith with the Voyage roller coaster. Kayla Smith is a person that is deathly scared of roller coasters, but she has overcome her fear and lives to tell the story. Give it up for Kayla.
Okay, so it all began when we went to church on Sunday, and the pastor came to my sister, Desire, and they were like, oh, we're going on a family church trip. We're going to Holiday World. And my sister was like, oh, that sounds nice. It sounds fun. We should go. So she told me and my nephew, and me and my nephew was like, fine, we'll go. It sounds fun. It's our first time. Let's go. So we get there. We rode the Raven. It was nice, smooth curves. It wasn't too high, so I wasn't as scared. So it was nice. Then we rode the Spider-Man one, and it was like throwing us somewhere, but it wasn't high, so it wasn't scary. Then my sister's like, oh, I want to get on that one, and I'm looking at it and it's going up and I'm getting scared. So we get there and I'm shivering, walking up the stairs scared, and I'm almost at this at the top, and I turn around and I'm like, I don't want to go, sis. I gotta go. I don't want to go. And I'm walking back upstairs. And I'm up the stairs, and then we're in the front, so it stops right in front of me. And I turn back around, and there are two guys are pushing me in there. And I'm like, no, I don't want to go. And I'm screaming at them, fighting at them, and I'm like, I'm not going. I don't want to go. And they get me in, and I'm screaming, get me out, get me out. And then my sister is right next to me laughing, ha ha, you got in. And I'm looking I don't like you. I was so mad. And then it's going up and it's jerking, and I'm freaking out, and then I didn't know what to do. So I just started praying. I was just please don't make me die. I'm just praying and stuff. And it falls, and I'm freaking out, and I'm opening my eyes, and I'm screaming. And my sister's calm down, sit down, chill. And I'm I sat down and I start chilling. And a few minutes later, it was it was over. And I had my eyes closed when it was going crazy vertical, sharp turns. And the movement just stops. And I opened my right eye first. And my sister's come on, it's over. Let's go. And I was crying, and I'm going down the stairs, and I'm so crying, and I'm red. My face is really cherry red. And we're walking to the car, because it was already time to go. I had a whole little tantrum. It was time for me to go. So I'm walking to the car, and all these little kids yeah, the voyage was all fun and stuff. It was all cool. And I'm thinking I was just crying a few minutes ago about this roller coaster. And it was just I just noticed I would never get on the roller coaster that voyage again, but I know to overcome my fears. Thank you for listening to my life story.
So in just a moment, we'll have our speaker, Scott Russell Sanders, which we are just delighted to have him here. After his presentation, we'll take a little bit of time for questions. And then we will have up to 10 30-second announcements. And Dave will have the clipboard if you want to check in. He's doing it all tonight. There's no stopping this guy. So if you would like to do an announcement, please do see Dave, and you can get on the list. It looks like there's room for about 7 more people. All right, with no further ado, I'd like to introduce Scott Sanders. He's a distinguished professor emeritus of English at Indiana University and the author of more than 20 books of fiction and nonfiction, including a couple of my favorites, Hunting for Hope and a conservationist manifesto. Among his honors are the Lannan Literary Award, the John Burroughs Essay Award, the Mark Twain Award, the Cecil Woods Award for Nonfiction, the Eugene and Mary Glick Indiana Authors Award, and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. In 2012, he was elected to be elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. As you can see, Scott is not just a treasure here in this community or the Hoosier State, but is a leading voice of reason nationally at a time when thoughtfulness, concern for the environment, and the Commonwealth are desperately needed. We are so pleased to have him here tonight. Please welcome Scott Russell.
In the 1830s, a French aristocrat named Alexis de Tocqueville came over to look at the raw, young American democracy, assuming he would despise it. He was surprised. There were a lot of things that did disgust him, people spitting their tobacco juice right and left on the steamboats and the rivers, but he also saw a lot to admire, and he made many visionary, perceptive remarks about the young country. One of them, to frame what I'm going to talk about here, was that he had never encountered people anywhere in his travels or about the Europe and about the world as greedy for private material gain, nor had he ever met people as zealous to pursue projects for the common good, to build roads, to build schools, community halls, to form legislatures, courts, and so forth. And he said, if the balance between greed for private material gain and zeal for public good, if that balance is maintained, this will be the greatest nation on earth. If one or the other wins out, it could undermine the very idea of democracy. He was right about that, and a short version of the history of the United States since its founding is that more and more power, more and more emphasis has been given to private wealth and less to the common good. So what I'm talking about here is the true meaning of wealth. If you ask a typical person in our society, or the proverbial alien from outer space, what we worship in this country, what we pay most attention to, what we talk about in the news and in newspapers and in conversations the most, it's certainly money. And if you say the word wealth, most Americans will think of money or stocks or bonds or perhaps very expensive possessions. A golden toilet, for example, just to pick a random disgusting example. Well, money actually has no intrinsic value. You can't eat it, you can't wear it, you can't build a house with it. You might be able to keep yourself warm by burning paper money for a while, but even a billionaire would get chilly pretty soon after the last embers winked out. So money has no intrinsic value. It is a social symbol, it's a social token, and it only functions if you have an underlying social contract. That is, in a setting where you have courts, you have laws, you have police, you have, in our case, Federal Reserve System, patent laws, all sorts of protections for money and contracts and patents. Without that, money is just numbers. It's only has exchange value. It has no intrinsic value. And by exchange value, I mean you can get stuff with it. You can buy a beer. And beer has intrinsic value. You can build a house by buying lumber or hiring a contractor, et cetera, et cetera. So money has exchange value. It can be exchanged for something that's truly useful. But money itself has no intrinsic use. And it does depend on a functioning society, and ultimately it depends on a social contract. So there's a profound paradoxical contradiction between being a billionaire and being a libertarian. Because if you're a billionaire, that means something only if you have a functioning society, including many regulations and laws and rules and constraints on individual behavior that libertarians are opposed to. We actually depend more profoundly for our well-being as individuals, as households, as communities, as a nation, and ultimately as a species. We depend far more on other forms of wealth than we do on money. Money's handy, and having enough to pay the bills, buy food, get transportation, having enough money to do all that, that's useful. But without what I call the commonwealth, no amount of money would make life bearable. The commonwealth, what I'm calling the commonwealth, you can think of it as having two different dimensions. One is natural wealth and one is cultural wealth. And natural wealth includes the earth with its breathable atmosphere. Well, one way to think about natural wealth, and I'll go give you some examples, is what you don't have on Mars, right? The billionaires who also say, let's go colonize Mars, where you do not have breathable air, you do not have drinkable water, you do not have fertile soil, you do not have oceans filled with marine life, you do not have a climate whose behavior for 10,000 years has been reasonably predictable. You do not have biodiversity on Mars. You do not have the whole legacy of the human genome on Mars, except for the small number of rich people who get flown there. So natural wealth is all of those gifts from nature that come to us through no effort of our own and really through no deserving of our own. We're born into a world with breathable air, drinkable water, fertile soil, teeming oceans, free-flowing rivers, forests, prairies, the rich diversity of other species that provide us many services, but also companionship and beauty. Much of that natural wealth, needless to say, is degraded or disrupted. The oceans are no longer teeming, at least not with edible fish. Plastic? Teeming with plastic, teeming with blue-green algae from agricultural runoff. So we certainly have degraded natural wealth, But our well-being depends ultimately and inescapably on those natural gifts. Cultural gifts include every form of knowledge. We're born into a world where much is known. People have figured out a lot of things. They've figured out how to cook things, how to make garments, how to build buildings that stand up. The whole history of science, the cumulative knowledge that science has provided, all the arts that human beings have made and that has come down to us. Every time I listen to Mozart in an elevator or wherever, I think, there's no way he could have known how much joy and deep, soul-wrenching meaning his art gives to people he could never have imagined, including a Hoosier guy in an elevator. Cultural wealth includes not only knowledge, it includes all those places where we transmit knowledge, such as schools and museums, and store it in places like libraries. Cultural wealth includes public lands. Obviously, the lands themselves are natural, but the fact that they're public, that they are protected in some ways, they are made available to ordinary people, forests and national parks. That's part of our cultural wealth. The founders of this country came from Europe, mostly the early ones from England. They came from a country where only rich people owned books. They came from a country where only rich people could send their children, and in that case, almost only males, to school. They came from a country where the parks had fences around them, and rich people lived inside those fences. And so while many of the founders, certainly a lot of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, were themselves rich men, they believed they set out to establish a society in which those goods, books, learning, parks, were not available only to rich people. So the idea of free public education was first formulated in the 1780s by Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. The idea of free public libraries was introduced in New England in the early 19th century. The idea of city parks and village parks went back to the 17th century, but the idea of national parks and later state parks was also invented in this country. We forget the legacy. Right now, I would say the administration in power is betraying the legacy of public amenities. That's at the core of democracy. Another cultural value, part of our cultural wealth, is a set of ideals. We all know that phrase in the Declaration of Independence that says all men are created equal. We also all know how far we have come short of fulfilling that. It was a long time before men included men with dark skin, when black men got the vote. It was even longer before any women, white or non-white, got the vote. And we're still far from fulfilling that ideal, but the idea that humans should, that everyone, every citizen should have the same opportunities in the court of law, the same opportunities for voting, that was a radical new idea. No culture had ever been so bold as to assert that all humans are created equal. It's always been assumed that humans fell into different classes and were entitled to different things. And while we haven't lived up to that ideal of equality, that ideal is a standard which we in our individual lives and in our courts today still struggle to embrace. That's part of our cultural wealth. The Constitution says, in order to form a more perfect union, it speaks about providing for the general welfare. It speaks about providing for posterity. It's a document that assumes that we're social creatures, that much of what matters to us is what we share. And again, although we are far from having lived up to those ideals of serving the general welfare, of forming a more perfect union, we have those ideals. That's an inheritance. A short version of the history of the U.S., as I said at the beginning, is that more and more of cultural commonwealth, cultural and natural commonwealth, has been transformed into private wealth. Forests have been cut down and created great fortunes. Oil and gas and coal have been dug or pumped out of the ground and created great fortunes. Industry has created fortunes while dumping its wastes into rivers and lakes and oceans. That accumulation of financial wealth has come, in many instances, at the expense of natural wealth and cultural wealth. In England, again, the place where the founding generations came from, what had been the commons, the shared forests, the shared pasture lands, the shared farming lands in the feudal system, what had been the commons was progressively enclosed, literally with fences, with sheriffs and gamekeepers around the edges. And the peasants were put outside. And that's an enclosure. Parliament passed over 5,000 acts, pieces of legislation, enclosing pieces of land that had once been common, had been shared. Maybe the man and woman in the manor were the ultimate owners, but the peasants, the ordinary people, had access to those common resources. That's where they got their firewood. That's where they went hunting. That's where they grew their food. And after the enclosures, only the people in the big house benefited from that land. Well, we have had and continue to have enclosures of all sorts of the commonwealth in our society. The airwaves are owned by us, by the public. They have been licensed often for free, but never for anything like their actual economic value. They have been licensed to private entities, individuals, and corporations that have used the public airwaves to enrich themselves, in part by charging political campaigns vast amounts of money to use the public airwaves to run for office. So the airwaves have been enclosed, or good portions of them. Organisms are being patented. Portions of the human genome have been patented, although that's been contested in the courts. Seeds that farmers have developed over centuries have had one or two molecular changes made to them and been patented so that the farmers can no longer use those seeds. Public tax money has been taken and is currently being taken out of the public schools and put into private schools, many of them religiously ordered. Public lands have been exploited and are continuing to be exploited. In many national forests, it costs more to build the roads to give access to the logging companies than the logging companies pay to cut and remove the trees. Grazing on Bureau of Land Management lands is priced at about one-third of what it would cost to graze a cow on private land. Mining on public lands still is governed by the Mining Act of 1872, which places a price of $5 an acre for mining. So you can mine uranium or lead or zinc or silver or whatever you can find at $5 per acre. And every effort to update that, like maybe $5 million an acre, has been defeated by the mining industry. The list could be extended. The important thing is to think about how the Commonwealth, natural and cultural Commonwealth, is the fundamental source of our well-being. Not money. At best, what money can enable us to do, if we have enough, is to draw on the riches of cultural and natural Commonwealth. Money does not provide or does not support our well-being. It's natural and cultural wealth. And that has been and is being systematically raided. I'm really avoiding being explicit about current actions, recent actions. They're not unique, but they're especially intensive. How do we counter this? I'm going to focus on local ways that we are, in fact, countering the enclosure of the commons. You could find examples in any community in America and in other countries. There are national and international organizations doing the kinds of things I'm going to briefly talk about. There are so many individuals, but especially groups in Bloomington and in Monroe County, enhancing the Commonwealth. WFHB was mentioned. That's part of the Commonwealth. We're in the Commonwealth right now, this gathering. WTIU, WFIU, Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, the Community Kitchen, Hoosier Hills Food Bank, the Sycamore Land Trust, Volunteers in Medicine, Middleway House. Many people in this room work in some of those organizations and many others that I haven't named. My friend Ross Gay, one of the people who founded the Community Orchard, said the first question that people who weren't involved in starting the Bloomington Community Orchard, one of the first questions they ask is, well, who gets the fruit? And Ross laughs and he says, we're just growing community here. We'll make sure somebody who's hungry for fruit gets the fruit. The farmers market, the city government, the county government. I was just talking with a friend after I came in this room who said, and I agree with him, he's about my age, that this city and this county have been well governed our whole time here. The people who run the government in any given time are not saints, they're human beings. There's recently been a very difficult and important argument about a vehicle for the police. It's not possible to make decisions, difficult decisions, that make everybody happy. But in my experience, and I've been here with my wife since 1971, this is a city where government sees itself as trying to enhance and care for and protect the Commonwealth. So we have trails, we have parks, we have the farmers market, which is supported by the city. We have performance venues like the Buskirk Chumley, which is also supported by the city. The city has many churches, it has a synagogue, it has a mosque, and the people in those congregations, as individuals and often as groups of people from congregations, engage in all sorts of good works in our community. All of those, and the list could go on and on, all of those are ways in which people recognize needs and get to join together with other people and meet those needs, or do as much as they can to meet those needs. Habitat builds houses. Shalom and other places provide shelter. And you might say, oh, well, that, those kinds of things, if you're doing something for marginalized people, people who don't have money, people who don't have power, how's that the Commonwealth? It's acting out the ideal of equality. If you've got a roof over your head and you can help somebody who has never had a reliable roof over his or her head or over their family, you serve the ideal of equality by swinging a hammer at a Habitat for Humanity build. And if you've got enough food in your house, so you never worry whether there's going to be enough food for the next meal, you serve the ideal of equality and compassion by donating food or donating money or growing food for Mother Hubbard's Cupboard or the Community Kitchen or the Hoosier Hills Food Bank. There's no division between caring for people and caring for the earth. Only in caring for the earth, ultimately, can we take care of people, including ourselves. So the framework that I want to leave you with, and even the term, it's a two-word term, Commonwealth, as an antidote to our society's obsession with private financial wealth. And it's not just individual financial wealth, it's corporate wealth. Money is deceased labor. A billionaire doesn't earn $1 billion. A billionaire gets $1 billion by taking some of the results of other people's labor. And if there are enough other people, they can take a few cents on the dollar and become a billionaire. There's no such thing as a self-made man or a self-made woman. Steve Jobs was born into a world in which computers, mathematics, metallurgy, logic, and thousands upon thousands of other human inventions and discoveries already existed. And everybody who builds a factory and starts manufacturing a widget hires people who were trained in schools and who drive to the factory on public roads. The person who builds the factory doesn't make all that money. Society collectively and nature collectively is the source of all wealth. What happens when large amounts of wealth are concentrated in a few hands is those few hands carry disproportionate power. That was true in 1776. It's even more true now because the technology available the media control available for those who command large amounts of private wealth, private financial wealth, are more powerful. That is, the technology is more powerful in enforcing a view of the world that money is what matters, that money is speech, as the Citizens United decision of January 2010 of the Supreme Court implicitly held, that money is speech. If those who own the media and those who increasingly own our legislatures at the state and federal level, and currently the White House, if those who own those places and those powers use their power to simply secure the financial wealth they have, they will continue to drive the devouring of the Commonwealth. If you're working on green projects, Citizens Climate Lobby is another local and, of course, national effort to address what we're doing, to redress what we're doing collectively to the climate. If you're working on green projects, you're working in allegiance with people who are addressing human needs in the community. And if you're addressing human needs in the community, you're working in allegiance with people who are trying to clean up our water and air and stabilize our climate and protect our biodiversity. We're all working to defend the Commonwealth. Thank you.
Things that we think about as part of the Commonwealth, like public libraries and national parks, actually came as gifts from wealthy industrialists. How do you make sense of that?
Well, there are wealthy people today who have a strong sense of giving back to the public. Whether it's Rockefeller's donating land that have become various national parks, Grand Teton, for example, was Rockefeller land. The Acadia National Park in Maine was Rockefeller and Carnegie land. David Koch's name is always listed, and I cringe, as one of the underwriters of, is it Nova or Nature?
Nova.
Nova on PBS. There are the names of rich people on Philharmonic halls and on public libraries and on buildings on campus. And that's fine with me. I'm grateful for those places, the parks, for example, the museums, the libraries, and so forth. And there has been, from the beginning, a tradition of noblesse oblige. If you have amassed great wealth, you have a responsibility to share the benefit, some of the benefit of that wealth, not just with your heirs, but with the public. Andrew Carnegie, who was a pirate, total pirate, and was at the time the richest man in America and maybe in the world, in 1885 published an essay called The Gospel of Wealth. He said, He started from a premise that I don't agree with, but his premise is no one will exert great effort unless he or she, he didn't say she, has an opportunity to amass great wealth. However, having amassed great wealth, you must realize you didn't create it. It was created by your workers and by society. He's dead right about that. And therefore, since it isn't ultimately your own creation, you should give it away before you die. And if you haven't done so, it should be taken away from you. He said, I am very encouraged, this is 1885, I am very encouraged to hear discussion of the idea of an estate tax, so that this is a pretty close paraphrase, any rich person dishonorable enough to die rich should have his, and he always said his money confiscated and returned to society. Andrew Carnegie. So but not all super rich people. And you don't have to be super rich. People with a few million dollars are just, that's petty cash for people, the billionaire class. Remember, $1 billion is 1,000 million. But people with a few million dollars can do a lot of good in a community the size of Bloomington by supporting the many, many good causes I mentioned. And of course, there's a huge, long list, much longer. And people always say, I don't want to name names because somebody I'll forget, and then they'll be mad at me. Well, in my case here tonight, I could list worthy local endeavors until the cows come home. But not enough rich people recognize that their wealth was created collectively, and that they have a responsibility to share some of it. I'm not saying they should be paupers at death, but that they have responsibility to share some of it with the society and its natural resources that created that wealth.
So we're creatures, and we have this strong yearning, okay, and hunger and desire. So is it possible to impose some sort of moral code that can, I mean, how does that offset these, what seem to be, and I'm probably wrong because I'm usually wrong about almost everything, those natural impulses to acquire. Anyway.
Okay, you know the answer to this, Dave. And you'll see right away that you know the answer to this. Remember I said that I don't grant Carnegie's premise. His premise was only the opportunity to amass great wealth will inspire people to great effort. Is that true of you, Dave?
Well, there you go.
Okay. is that why you play the guitar, Dave? No, is that why you are such a energy-conserving genius? No, I'm not being sarcastic. There are people all over this room who work their hearts out because they love what they're doing. They may be serving a need. They may be making some kind of art. They may be teaching. And they're not sure people need to have a living. We know that. But it's not why most people exert themselves. They exert themselves because the thing they're doing, they love doing. It's meaningful. It has a purpose. It is satisfying. It requires skill. It gives an outlet to their creativity. So you can aspire, you can desire infinitely as an artist and work your whole life and get better and better and better at your art. But you don't devour the world.
You've been listening to the third series of student stories from the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship and Green Drinks with In Defense of the Commonwealth.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.